Disasters are a reality of life in the Pacific, but so is the strength and resilience of its people. Pacific Prepared shares first-hand stories from communities on the ground, drawing on tradition, culture, and collective wisdom to stay safe and support one another in times of disaster. Pacific Prepared explores how communities are adapting and protecting what matters most. Search up ABC Pacific Prepared to listen online or find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an ABC podcast.
Bon dia, Kasalilie, Ali, and good following morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. On the show today, women's group in Vanuatu calling for reforms after pardons have been given to men with multiple sexual offences against young girls. The search is on for six people missing at sea in Vanuatu, and certain islands within Fiji are on high alert after the spread of the Tongan fruit fly. All those stories and more coming up shortly here on Pacific Beat, where we come to you from the lands of the Wurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Egi Tupo, and Fafitai Tile Lava. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with women's groups in Vanuatu calling on the government to reform the process of granting presidential pardons after men convicted of sexual abusing children received pardons. In the lead-up to Independence Day last month, President Nikenike Vurumbaravu pardoned 13 prisoners, including a former Speaker of Parliament and two men jailed for multiple sexual offences against young girls. The move sparked alarm in the community, and this week Prime Minister Jotham Napat said he too was deeply concerned and that he would meet with the president to ask him to revoke the pardons. In a statement, he said he respects the president's constitutional powers, but people deserve justice, and that the government will review the pardoning powers and propose a clear set of guidelines to guide decision making. Meanwhile, the president of the Port Vilet City Council of Women, Jane Yatika, says pardoning men convicted of sexually abusing children sends a dangerous message. Here she is speaking to our Vanuatu reporter, Lily Rose Walwell.
Because sexual violence cases are treated as serious crimes, many people feel surprised, worried about the cases, but then it sends out a message to the survivor and the public of where their safety stands.
So what are the women in your association saying to you since this pattern became public?
In our organization, because we work mainly with the women, a lot of them are worried because of the safety of the women and girls in our communities. And a lot are talking about the trust they will have to their related relatives whom they think they cannot trust anymore, just to leave their daughters or younger children with them because they do not know what's in the mind of that person that they are leaving their children with. So that is one of the main decisions or what we have talked about in our group.
Do you feel this decision shows women and children's safety is in a priority at the highest levels?
Firstly, I would say when it comes to pardoning a sexual offender or a person that has a rape case against him, I would say in a pattern like this, the sexual violence case can feel like it is minimizing the crime, where especially the survivor and the advocacy groups will look at. It has also raised a concern about whether there is a law and a punishment and accountability at its highest level or there isn't any.
Is the government's promise pardon criteria enough, or should it go further like a legislation?
It depends on what the current pardoning criteria is actually about and how transparent it is applied. But to refer to whether the current promise criteria is enough, from the public reaction in Vanuatu, the many of us will feel it isn't. especially when serious sexual offences are included in the pardoning. We would like to see legislations that are set clearly and transparent, and advisory process would make it more predictable and could help rebuild the trust in the community.
What message do you want the head of state and the prime minister to hear directly from you as a woman leader in Port Vila?
I have quite a long message. Your Excellency, or the head of state, and Your Excellency, the Honourable Prime Minister, on the behalf of women and girls of Port Vila, we respect the constitutional powers of the presidency. However, when serious crimes against women and children are pardoned, it weakens public trust in justice and undermines the safety of our communities. We therefore call on the head of state and the government to, one, establish clear legislation to guide the use of pardon of powers with specific exclusions of sexual offences against women and children. Two, ensure transparency through a public advisory process that includes victims' voices and relevant women's safety agencies. Three, reaffirm the protection of women and children in national priority at the highest level of leadership. We are not trying to remove the power of pardon. We are asking that it be used with care, transparency, and with the well-being of women and children as the first test.
And that there is President of the Port Vila City Council of Women, Jane Yatika, speaking to Lily Rose Wellwell. Meanwhile, the head of the country's correctional service say they have faced criticism of the president's decision to pardon those 13 convicted prisoners. Correctional Services Director Johnny Marango says his organisation had no role in the decision and should not be blamed. He told the ABC that the decision to grant the pardons rested solely with the president.
Constitutional power under Article 38, MEP Law President,
The Constitution under Article 38 gives the president the power to exercise his power of mercy, and parole is for the parole board only. As the director, I do not have any power to make recommendations for anyone to be released on pardon or parole. There are clear policies in place to address these issues.
Something about the parole, that when you are released...
With parole, when someone is released, they still have reporting and monitoring requirements with us. We do home visits and appoint community justice supervisors. But when someone who is on parole is pardoned, it means they are completely removed from our supervision and automatically become a free man who does not need to report back to us.
And that is Johnny Marango, the Director of Correctional Services, responding to public criticism aimed at himself and his office over the recent decision by Vanuatu's president to pardon 13 prisoners, including two men convicted of rape.
Discover the stories that shape our region on Culture Compass. Travel across the Pacific with Afamasanga Sayuli Salamasina von Reiki as she traces the shift from oral traditions to online connections and explores the delicate balance between conservation and cultural practice across the islands. Culture Compass, a journey through resilience, revival and deep connection. Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Me taki mata, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now we stay in Vanuatu, where a search is continuing for six people missing at sea after the banana boat they were travelling on failed to reach its destination. The vessel left Eromango bound for Tana, but never arrived. Authorities are now searching for the boat and its passengers. Joining us now is Joe Lautum, the Secretary General of Tafia Province. With that, I say good morning, Mr. Lautum. Welcome to Pacific Beat.
Good morning, Aki.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning. If you don't mind, Mr. Iotam, could you give us an update on search efforts to actually locate the six missing people?
Yes, thank you. The search has started since Saturday, and until now we have still not found any signs of the missing boat. The New Caledonia services have provided us with the sets as well as the domestic airplanes here with four ships that have sets along the western coast of the island, especially the Eromango and Tana Island and the Tafia province, with nothing. I mean, they haven't found anything. They did not spot any signs of the boat as of yesterday. Help One, which is another health rescue ship, was doing the southeastern part of the island, and that's including between the islands of Aniwa, Futuna, and Anecho. And this morning as well, we have the provincial boat doing the it's already gone off, and it's searching the eastern to the northeastern part of the island of Eromango, and that's between the island of Aniwa, Eromango, and up towards the Efate Island. So that's the operation that's still going on at the moment. And if we don't get any results today by this evening, and then maybe we'll make a decision whether we should continue with the sets.
Sure.
Or we should call it off because we know it's taken almost it's going towards a week, and it's a while if there are no signs, and then we have to make a decision whether we should continue.
Yes, of course. And Mr. Yeltsin, I know you said the search had begun since Saturday, but when did the boat actually go missing? And are you aware of who were the passengers on board?
The boat left Eromango on Friday morning, with other two boats. We have the information that the boat is new. It's got a 50 horsepower engine, which is also new, and it's got a six passengers on board. That's including one student. We are not really clear which school that student is from, but we know the other five are adults with the families. I mean, they have family. On the way to Tana, the weather wasn't really good on Friday. Yesterday, Friday, the weather was not really good. But the two other boats made it to the island, and they were expecting the other one to come through as well. But later on that Friday evening, the boat did not come ashore. So they were suspecting maybe it came ashore on other areas though. So they have to search the other areas, and then they come to realize that no, the boat didn't make it ashore. So on Saturday the message started going around, and on Sunday we just have the information that no, that there's a missing boat. So we start mobilizing on late Saturday, Sunday, until now.
Are the waters around Eromango, an unsafe place to usually boat around?
Yes, there are a few places that the boats can go ashore, but most of the places around is not quite safe. We have high waves in there, but Sunday, Monday, the sea have actually gone down, and we have ships sailing in from Port Vila on Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. So the sea has actually come down at the moment. But actually, we have the small boats as well searching the coastlines of the island of Eromango and around Tana as well. But we haven't seen any signs of the missing boat.
Yeah, and we know that Eromango is a small population of about 2,000 people. This has probably come as a shock, right, to that very tight-knit community.
Yes, it's quite a big shock to the community at the moment. Actually, we have the area administrator also reporting that he has informed the boat captain and the chief about the rough seas, but they insisted because I think that they've been traveling the same sea over the the past few years, and we're expecting that they will be doing okay, but unfortunately it's not that has been happening.
Do you think, Mr. Iatam, this incident has pretty much prompted discussions on whether there needs to be, you know, greater regulations or awareness for ocean travellers?
Yes, yes. I have been discussing that with the authorities. Authorities here, that we need to strengthen the regulations, because we need to be very strict on which boats should be sailing across the islands. And I think that's something that has not been tightened or strengthened so far. We have any boats sailing across the island and they don't have the safety equipment, and sailing also on rough waters, and that has been a practice for a while.
Yes, was there any sign, or did anyone know whether the boat had life jackets on it?
Yeah, that's the information that we don't have. We don't have any information at all whether there's any safety equipment on the boat. All we know is that all the people, the passengers on board, have left their phone, mobile phones, on the other boats that came ashore. So that's where everything has just gone. The communication has just gone completely broken down.
Well, as you said, Mr. Iatam, it's nearly approaching a week now with the search for those six people. Look, we hope for a good outcome, but we know that you guys are working hard to bring home safely those families that are missing. So, yeah, I just want to say thank you so much, Mr. Iatam, for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Joe Iatam, Secretary General of Tafia Province, right here on Pacific Beat.
Wherever you're listening, from Timor to Tonga, ABC Radio Australia is yours in the Pacific, yours for news.
Me taki ma'ata and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, Fiji and Palau, they've put their hands up to host a major Pacific climate meeting.
Yours for sport.
Welcome everyone to Nijin Footy, the best place for Pacifica footy news and stories in the rugby league and rugby union world.
Yours for music.
Aaron Sister Sounds are heading from Fiji to Aotearoa for something a little bit different, to an artist called Ma. She's got such a unique style, singing in her Maori.
Yours for Pacific stories.
Lafi Moala, welcome to Stories from the Pacific. Now, what made you decide to create Times of Tonga?
It was a time that I need to make a contribution to my country.
And yours for celebrating Pacific culture.
Niger Daily producer took a trip to the Te Papata Arts Centre.
Skilled artisans creating traditional Samoan objects out of material.
Wherever you are, ABC Radio Australia is yours in the Pacific.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges. From how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've just joined us, Vinaka, thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. Right now, this is just a quick recap of what's been on the show so far. Now, a women's group in Vanuatu are calling for reforms after pardons given to men with multiple sexual offences against young girls. There is a search for six people missing at sea in Vanuatu. Now, still coming up, we've got certain islands within Fiji on high alert after the spread of the Tongan fruit fly. But right now, let's get into your news wrap.
Hold the front page!
Vinaka Vakalevo, welcome back to Pacific Beat as we head around the region to get the latest headlines. And that's always brought to you by our producer, Dana Kirimov. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Yeah, oh. Well, I'm here.
Yep. And that is always
the goal, is to make it here. So, you know, thank you very much. It's Wednesday, it's hump day, but there is a lot happening around the region. Mm. This one first, looking into the upcoming general elections in Fiji, where I believe the elections office accidentally jumped the gun and circulated a false election announcement. Goodness.
Yeah, so this one was part of a rehearsal for the actual upcoming elections, a mock press release on the issuance of a writ that would kickstart the next election process, including details like a made-up election date, update was uploaded onto the FEO's website. In a subsequent press release, the FEO announced that all of the information contained in the mock press release, including that date, was entirely fictitious and created solely for the purposes of the rehearsal.
Oh, wow.
But the good thing is that the purpose of this rehearsal process is to identify gaps in the election writ process, so this has certainly done that, at least probably not as publicly as I was hoping for.
Yes. Do we actually know the date for the upcoming elections?
No, so we don't. But the best way to think about it is just pretend that that mock announcement never happened. As far as we're aware, just constitutionally, the next general elections could still be announced anywhere between now and the 24th of December.
Yes.
With the actual elections themselves likely happening between mid-December and, late December and early February next year.
All right, good to know. Okay, let's move to Solomon Islands, where the government has updated their list of political appointments to 54. Now, that's with four more appointees waiting to be signed on.
So political appointments are roles within the Prime Minister's private office designed to provide advice and support to the government. Now, the exact number of political appointees wasn't known until now, with the opposition demanding that number be revealed last month, suggesting that it had surged to more than 70. And the reason that that number is important is because these political appointees are publicly funded.
Yes.
And according to estimates from In-Depth Solomons, should the remaining four appointees be signed on, it would cost the government $21.61 million annually.
Yeah, that's not chump change at all. Okay, I'm wondering, what has the Prime Minister said about the number of political appointments?
Now, he hasn't addressed the specific number of political appointments, but when questioned earlier in June about what that number was, Prime Minister Wale said that while the cost is a consideration, it can't dictate the number of people that the government needs, according to In-Depth Solomons. And he said that the government had an ambitious program, so that the important thing was the quality of the appointments themselves.
Of course, that makes sense. All right, now let's head to a bit of sport. I believe cricket, the PNG women's team, are playing host to Thailand and Port Moresby this week. So, how are things going for the Lewis?
Well, after two T20 matches, the five-match series is all square. PNG won game one by 5 wickets, but Thailand got their revenge in the second, winning by 6 wickets. Today is a rest day before the action resumes at Amini Park on Thursday with the first of the 3 one-day internationals. And PNG's head coach, Mahuri Dai, says that it's an important week for his team.
This ODIs and T20 match is a world ranking games, and it's important to both country that we must win and then improve our positions in the world.
So will there be more later in the year?
Yes, similar series with either Thailand or different associate countries.
Now, Mahuri Dai, who made a first-class century for PNG during his playing career, but now his focus is very much on coaching the Lewas.
Right, beautiful. Great stuff happening across there, but also appreciate you coming through and sharing those headlines across the region here on Pacific Beat.
Join Natasha Metten for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores the issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
Cut to me landing in Tonga and showing up on my auntie's doorstep, and they had no idea I was coming. It was late at night and they had no idea who I was. I felt the full weight of my adoption at that time.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to sport now. The Football Association in Papua New Guinea could be told to hand back the trophies won by the Couples and the Billums at the MSG Prime Minister's Cup in 2024 and 2025. But for once, the finger isn't pointing at the PNGFA. Instead, it's the PNG Sports Foundation that stands accused. The MSG tournament is government funded, but for the last 3 years, the Sports Foundation has not been paying PNG's share. The players haven't been paid and neither have the fees that allow PNG to take part in the first place. Former national team manager Joseph Yuladona has been closely involved in organising the tournament, rather, the last of which was staged in Port Moresby 9 months ago. And he says he is not at all surprised that the PNGFA have decided to pull out of this year's event in Fiji.
In this case, the PNGFA only selects the team and trains the team. The upkeep of the players is the responsibility of the government agency responsible for sports, and that's the PNG Sports Foundation.
So, in essence, what the president of the PNGFA, John Caponado, is saying is if the money that is due from the foundation is handed over, they could still go. Would that be right?
Well, I think they're expressing their frustration, and people like me who've been heavily involved also assisting the PNG Sports Foundation and, you know, trying to seek government support. The first MSG PM's Cup, inaugural one in Vanuatu, yes, they were given the allowances. Following that, the second one in New Caledonia, I think, and then the Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea, the players are still waiting for their allowances. And a lot of players have expressed their frustration. A lot of players in the past two tournaments have discussed boycotting the tournament because of non-payment, but because of the passion for football, they continue. And now the PNGFA, I guess, has taken that stand because the players are, I must tell you, they're very frustrated.
So, bearing in mind what you've just told me, it seems to me the PNGFA have got a case here, haven't they? Because this has been going on for 3 years.
As a matter of fact, I agree that PNGFA has a case. This is a government-sanctioned tournament mandated by the prime ministers of Vanuatu, PNG, Solomon Islands, Fiji, and New Caledonia. So, governments of respective countries are responsible for their upkeep, their travel, their allowances, their accommodation, etc., etc. So, yes, PNGFA has a case. I've been involved in preparing requests for funding from relevant government agencies, but that's not seem to be his priority over this. And, you know, that's why I said this is a total embarrassment to our prime minister, total embarrassment to the country, to football in the country. We're a big nation, and we are seen to be the big brother in this country. And yet, we come to football, they thought about us. Accordingly, initiated revival of the Melanesia Cup and now the MSGPM's Cup. And for us to not go, it's total embarrassment to the country.
So, on the one hand, do you anticipate that perhaps the Prime Minister might step in and try and sort this out? Or on the other hand, do you think perhaps that he and his government have rather brought it on themselves because the Sports Foundation is not functioning, it would seem to me, in the way that it should be functioning?
Yeah, I guess so. A lot of governance issues at the Sports Foundation, and I know they're under investigation. The CEO is amongst those 70 or so heads of department suspended for non-compliance or reporting to the government. So a lot of issues at PNG Sports Foundation. But in this case, I'm aware requests have been put, but as it is, really not enough support given, especially in relation to the payment of players. Last year, it was also in Papua New Guinea. I'm aware some payments were done to some service providers, but then our players didn't get paid. I've sent some messages to the Prime Minister's office, so we see what happens. We must do something, otherwise we're just looking stupid. And, you know, Richard, it is for the development of our players. We are aiming to go to the FIFA World Cup. That's the ultimate. And the MSG governments, MSG prime ministers, in their wisdom, adopted this amongst other strategies to prepare our team to qualify for the World Cup. And that's why, you know, it's so bad. And personally, I'm happy that John Capinato, president, has made this decision to show people that, look, we can't do this ourselves. We need to have government support. This is a government-sanctioned tournament supported by OFC and FIFA. Another aspect also, you know, PNG, now I have to say it, we have not paid our registration fees for the last 3 years. And the competition rule says we must pay. Otherwise, all our wins are nullified. So, you know, this is a big matter.
So if I interpret what you just said correctly, does that mean that PNG could have the trophy that they won taken off them?
If they follow the rules of the book, yes. We are supposed to pay registration fees in order to compete. We have not. Somebody needs to be held responsible and accountable.
And that there is former PNG national team manager Joseph Yiladonis talking to Richard Hewitt. Now, Pacific Beat has been in touch with the Sports Foundation asking for their side of the story, but we are still awaiting the promised response.
Pacific Beat.
All right, an emergency declaration still remains in force for the Yasawa Group in Mamanuta Islands in Fiji as biosecurity authority try to contain the spread of the Tongan fruit fly. Officials are warning people before any travel plans are made to ensure they are not carrying restricted fruits, particularly mangoes, guavas, papayas, avocados and even tomatoes. The pest is a serious threat to Fiji's agriculture, food security and the livelihoods of its community. Failure to comply could result in a fine of up to 40,000 Fijian dollars. Now joining us to speak more on this is Chief Plant Protection Officer at the Biosecurity Authority of Fiji, Mr. Nitish Dutt. With that, I say Yandra Nitish, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Yandra. Andravinakal from Fiji.
Thank you. Nitish, could you just at least maybe give us a brief explanation of what a Tongan fruit fly is and why is it considered such a pest?
Thank you. So the Tongan fruit fly, which we also call it as a Bactrocera officialis, is a regulated pest for Fiji. So it's a pest that has been just detected last year in Fiji. And previously, it was not in the country. It's been mainly found in the Tonga. And for that reason, we have been commonly referring it as a Tongan fruit fly. Mm. And it's a serious, as you mentioned, it's a serious pest for us because of the damages it can do to the fruits and the vegetables. And therefore, we had to implement the emergency declaration just to assist us in our emergency response on the island. Yeah.
Mm. And how widespread is the problem in Fiji right now, though?
Yeah, initially it was quite widespread on the Mamanuda and Asawa Islands, knowing that those Asawa groups have multiple islands. But for now, it has been well contained, and there are a couple of the islands that has been totally eradicated with the fruit fly. So that's a positive result for us.
Yes, that is. So then I'm just wondering then, has there been a bit of impact, though, on farmers or even consumers, you know, in terms of food supplies?
So the islands are basically, they don't have any major commercial production areas, but the challenge for us is we don't want this particular pest to reach to the mainland where the major agricultural sector sits on. And if it reaches there, that's where I would see the impact. So our aim is to contain it and eradicate while it is still on those islands.
Nice. Well, Nitish, what kind of fruits does the Tongan fruit fly usually target?
Generally, any fruit fly would target like mango, guava, papaya, citrus, tomatoes, and there are also wild fruits. They are not mainly for consumptions, but those are the wild fruits that could be also the host or a breeding place for this fruit fly. So, yeah, it's quite tricky as what are the host, and because this is a new fly for Fiji, we still have to establish what are the multiple hosts that this particular fruit fly can impact on.
Mm.
But generally, those are the
yes
normal host.
Well, so then, Nitish, you know, with the Biosecurity Authority of Fiji, what's your usual response, or how do you actually try and contain or even eradicate the Tongan fruit fly?
So in a biosecurity response, what we do is we deploy a massive trapping system. These are using the lures that basically attracts the male fruit flies. And we also spray a lot of the protein baits, which attracts both the male and the female fruit flies. So basically what we are trying to do with this is massive trapping of the fruit fly on the islands and also to disturb their breeding cycle. And once we are able to disturb their breeding cycle, then we are able to reduce the population significantly.
Mm. Now, I understand that there was a fine that is going to be placed on those who possibly could be caught, right, with transporting fruit between these two villages. Did I have it correct in the beginning around the up to at least maybe 40,000? Is that correct? Or how much could someone be fined if they do transport that fruit between the two villages?
No, the maximum fine is around 1,000 Fijian dollars. The $40,000, that is a fee that could be the maximum laid by the court. But generally, when we have any breach of our regulations, then the maximum fine that we impose, that is within the $1,000 and not 40,000. That's when someone is failed to pay the fees or fine, then it goes to the court, and then it could basically be what maximum that could be imposed by the court. But it's $1,000, yeah.
Ah, that makes sense. Thank you very much. And Nitish, what role can everyday Fijians do there, the public, particularly, you know, when they are travelling between islands and there is movement of fresh fruit and vegetables?
I mean, just to let you know, we are very grateful with our communities out there in Asawa and Mamanudas. We initially had some breaches, but we have very high compliance with our communities out there, and which we are very grateful. And it basically now supports our work, because moving these host fruits, as I mentioned, to the mainland could basically bring the fruit fly. And if it's undetected, it could be widely spread within the mainlands where the agricultural sector is. So we are grateful with our communities, but we again request to all our communities and the travelers between the islands that avoid bringing the fruits from the islands to the mainland. And if unsure, our biosecurity officers are always at the domestic port of entries, and they can verify and assist the travelers whether those fruits could be brought in or not, because we do not want to impose any fines to our communities.
I'm interested in around climate change though, Nitesh, because I'm wondering with, you know, the changing weather patterns and things like that, would that make fruit fly outbreaks I suppose more difficult to control in the future?
Yes, climate change and the changing weather patterns are a significant impact, because for us, this particular incursion, we believe it's through the potentially through a cyclone or the wind pattern that we have around the islands, and that may have brought in the fruit fly. So yes, and we also noted that the climate change also has the impact on the adaptability of the fruit flies or any other general pest. They tend to be hot temperatures are quite more conducive at times, and so that could lead to more breeding populations than in a usual scenario.
Well, what lessons then can Fiji and maybe even just across the Pacific learn from this, you know, when it comes to tackling invasive pests like this?
So the very important for us for Biosecurity Authority of Fiji was that we had a very good surveillance system out there on the outer islands. And that led us to the timely monitoring and then capturing this particular fruit fly on our radar. If we do not have a proper surveillance system out in the outer regions, then it will be difficult to detect what comes into the country. So, yes, I think a surveillance system is one of the key priorities. But generally also a lot goes on our travelers around the region, especially the yachts and so on, that they need to well adhere to the biosecurity requirements just to, you know, avoid indirectly bringing any particular pest to the country.
Well, Mr. Dutta, I really appreciate you coming through today to just share and do a little bit of an insight into the Tongan fruit fly there in Fiji. Looks like you guys are doing some great work in basically containing that pest. But thank you again for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. Thanks.
That is Nitesh Dutta, Chief Plant Protection Officer at the Biosecurity Authority of Fiji.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, a Pacific Islander trade unionist in Australia says she is very concerned about the ongoing poor working conditions faced by Pacific Island workers engaged under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme in Australia. Queensland-based Gwen Amankwatoa, who hails from Vanuatu, made this comment after an ABC Four Corners program featured stories from Pacific Island workers facing serious problems with fair wages and proper accommodation. Some have likened the situation to the blackbirding days of the 1800s, when Pacific Islanders were shipped to Queensland to work in the sugarcane plantations. Gwen Amankwatoa spoke with Caroline Turman.
About 2012, I think it was, that I took a drive one day. I had a cousin who was working here in Queensland out west, who had come from Vanuatu, and I went there to visit him, and this is over 10 years ago. My sister was visiting from Vanuatu, and we decided to take a drive and visit him out in regional Queensland. And I was appalled and shocked at the situation in which I found my cousin, and it wasn't just him, but it was him and the men who had come with him from Vanuatu at that time. So the issue of, you know, that workers are experiencing, especially those of us coming from the islands, experiencing in farms here in Australia is not new. It's been, you know, an issue that's been identified years ago. Obviously, there's a lot to be done. Yes. So I guess in terms of that, I've been hearing a lot of stories. Also, because I'm also an organizer with United Workers Union, so I get to go out and speak with a lot of workers out there, and I hear a lot of stories.
Have you seen some changes since your visit to your relatives all those years ago?
I think it's really difficult to respond directly to that. Although I can say that, you know, I've heard many stories. I've read as well many of these stories and seen on television, read in the newspaper, and seen, you know, online news as well. It's really disappointing that the issues that our workers are facing are still ongoing. And I think this is an issue that, to me personally, reminds me and feels to me like a second wave of slave trading. You know, blackbird, so we know of our South Sea Islanders who were brought to, you know, the cane fields of Queensland in the early 1900s, late 1800s, coming into Queensland and working in the sugar cane field. And I feel like this is a second wave of these workers coming in again and being treated as slaves in this country. What bothers me is the fact that many of these workers are not able to exercise their right to leave an employer where they feel they're not satisfied with the job that they're doing, they're not happy with the pay that they're receiving, to be able to transfer into another job. So that's what I'm hearing from workers on the ground, and that bothers me.
These terrible working conditions that people are saying they are experiencing, what is that doing to their mental health, do you think?
So there's a lot of workers who come here because they have families at home to support, and many of them actually leave their children behind. And we try and put ourselves into the shoes of these workers. Imagine leaving a young child behind and coming out here to work to be able to support your family at home. It's really, really difficult. And when you come here, you're going through these experiences, it affects them. You know, and then who do they turn to? And in these times, what I say to workers, yes, I'm an Ivanuatu, but I'm also a person who believes in unions and the work that unions do. And I encourage workers from the island to come out here, just, you know, not just the island, but any worker here in Australia, to join their union, because the conditions that workers face in the workplace is and are conditions that you sometimes and in most cases are not able to fight yourself. It is something that you have to join as a collective to be able to fight and to be able to also present your case to government.
These schemes are often said to be very beneficial for Pacific Islanders, but are they?
It would be beneficial if both sides benefit. So this is something that I guess, you know, labour hire companies, governments, unions, and all bodies that are responsible for looking after workers, including, I guess, labour organisations back in the home countries of these workers, should be able to sit down together and, I guess, you know, look at what issues workers are facing, you know, when they're in Australia, and whether they have been given enough information as well and education about the working conditions when they're in another country, and, you know, in our case here in Australia. So I think it's something that and could be beneficial, but I think there needs to be a lot of education around workers' rights before they leave their home country to come to Australia.
And that right there is Gwen Amankwato speaking there with Caroline Tiriman. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Looking back at some of our main stories, women's group in Vanuatu calling for reforms after pardons given to men with multiple sexual offences against young girls.
In a pardon like this, the sexual violence case, can feel like it is minimizing the crime.
And still in Vanuatu, the search for six people continues who are missing at sea after the banana boat they were travelling on failed to reach its destination.
By this evening, and then maybe we'll make a decision whether we should continue with the search.
We'll be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. News is next, and coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. Till next time, Adua Afatu. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.